Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Public Sector Voices. Your usual host Emily Rogers leads today's episode, but introducing it is me, fellow podcast host Ailsa Cowan. Today's guest is Martina Kane, who is Policy and Engagement Manager at the Health Foundation. So thank you for joining us today, Martina.
Thank you for having me.
We know already that there's a huge link between employment and the health in young people. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've done on this?
Yeah, so the Young People's Future Health Inquiry that I work on for the Health Foundation has been really keen to show that young people's future health is really influenced by the wider things that surround them, things like the job that they do. So we spent a number of years talking to young people themselves, but really building the evidence base with academics, looking at the data and looking at the available literature to try and explore how, if you can get young people off to the best possible start in life, then it's likely to really make sure that they have a much healthier midlife and a much healthier older age. And work is a classic example of that. So if someone is in a great financially rewarding job that's secure, that gives them purpose, that can influence their health in all manner of ways. So it influences their identity, which then has a knock-on impact for their mental health. It also provides them with a stable income, which can not only enable them to access better housing, pay for better quality food, but also sort of insulates them against some of the shocks that might come along in life, which are then again has an impact on the body, because those sort of stresses and strains really have a biological impact. And we know that some of the first years that people have, those sort of first steps into work, can be some of the most important ones in really establishing them in the world of work. So it's really important to make sure that young people have access to, great first opportunities, really good pathways that mean that they get into secure and rewarding work for their long-term health.
That's amazing. So this is where your research has kind of brought you. But how did you go about collecting that data? I mean, did you speak to a lot of young people or?
So we've been working on this for quite a while. And one of the first things we did was work with more than 100 young people all over the UK, doing focus groups and polls and other things to understand what really supported them between the ages of 12 and 24 to get into good work, good housing, and have strong relationships with their friends, families and communities. And sort of through those young people, we worked to develop a model that really showed how skills were incredibly important, financial support, so having a sort of financial safety net that they could rely on if they needed to is important, how emotional support was really important, but how sort of personal connections, so the people around you who can just give you a bit of advice about budgeting or a bit of advice about how to fill in a rental contract or can open those doors into employment opportunities, were actually really, really important as well. So from that point, we then worked with a team over at UCL to look at the longitudinal data sets and see how those connections really bore out in some of the questionnaires that they've been asking for sample of young people across the years. And it showed that there were really strong associations between all of those four things and good housing, good work and good relationships with friends, families and communities. And then we've also done a separate piece of work where we worked to train up around 15 peer researchers in 5 places across the UK. So we went to Bristol and Bradford, we went to North Ayrshire in Scotland, we went to Lisburn in Northern Ireland, and we went to Denbighshire in North Wales, and trained up those peer researchers to go out and talk to other young people in their community about what the real opportunities were in their places, but what also the barriers were to them being able to get the things that they needed in order to get themselves into secure work, into secure housing and to have those strong relationships. And then most recently, we've been working with a number of policy organisations to try and really see what needs to happen at the national policy level to really make sure that the environment's there that young people can really thrive in.
So what happens to those young people who don't have the things that you mentioned, like the financial safety net and this emotional support around them? Like, how do we kind of ensure that they can get the same opportunities really to have a good life?
I mean, so with all young people, it's definitely a spectrum. One of the reasons we chose to look at the 12 to 24 age group is we know that it's a time of great change, and it's a time of real biological change and real sort of social and emotional change. But it's also a time when sort of interventions might work, essentially. And that's, you know, that's the theory that most of the education system is based on, is that, you know, if you sort of can take young people through a route, actually at the end of it, they might be better off than they would have been without it. So things like really great youth services can make a massive difference to young people and can provide some of those things that young people might not, you know, might not be getting in their home environment or might not be getting it at school. But also making sure that in each local area, young people can do and get to the things that they need. So things like transport came out incredibly importantly at our sort of in our place-based work, in that if young people just simply couldn't get to the things that were around, then they weren't really opportunities for them. Making sure that there's a sort of great offers to young people in a particular place, particularly around making sure there's affordable housing, you know, high quality work, but also connecting people up is just incredibly important to make sure that it's not just the richest young people that can thrive, it's everybody.
Yeah, so once you have kind of all of this data and you know what needs to be done, how do you go about then informing government policy or making a difference on a top-down level?
So as I say, one of the main ways we work is in partnership with other people. So one of the main things that the Health Foundation is a charitable funder. So we've worked quite a lot with other policy organisations to try and sort of give them some capacity to work with and understand these issues. So last year we worked with a series organisation to produce a series of reports around young people and these wider determinant of health themes. So for example, we worked with the Chartered Institute for Housing to produce a report on housing that we then sort of fed in, that really looked at areas of the private rental housing market and changes that should be coming through. And we're continuing on with this work in the current environment too. So we've funded a number of posts at organisations like the Institute for Employment Studies. And those policy fellows are going to work for 3 years specifically looking at these issues and working up recommendations that, you know, we can provide to government and others to, you know, take forward.
Yeah. And is it the case that more or less what you suggest they normally take on board, or is it more difficult than that?
I mean, it's always always more difficult than that, and you know, we're a strongly evidence based organisation, and we really try and make sure that the evidence building is there. The other thing that's been that is a challenge is that sort of young people as a group are quite often have often fallen through the cracks. And what's been sort of really reassuring over the last couple of weeks is to be sort of seeing some of the more focus on young people that we might not have seen in previous crises that have come through.
Yeah, like with the Chancellor's announcement the other week to support young people into jobs. I mean, how is that going to affect the health of young people?
The Chancellor's Summer Statement was a really, really welcome focus on this age group. And we can't, so I can't emphasise enough how important, how high quality work is, you know, particularly for this age group and for their long-term health. So the focus on youth employment right now is really, really welcome. I think one of the things that we're always cautious with things like this are is that these measures are a great step in the right direction, but the challenge is really going to be around implementation, and especially as these are really ambitious plans, and we wouldn't want to see them any less ambitious, but similar schemes in the past have had higher budgets in order to deliver lower targets. So we really need to make sure that, you know, this pandemic's widened existing health inequalities, and we need to make sure that, you know, the next generation, we're not going to see the same health inequalities played out over again, and these young people aren't going to be disproportionately affected for the rest of their lives. We're really pleased to see the focus from the Chancellor in the Summer Statement on young people, but yeah, we're really going to be watching closely and seeing how that pans out.
And I suppose the important thing is not just to have a job, but to have a good job and one that does support a healthy lifestyle. So what kind of opportunities do you see for young people kind of in this landscape that we're in now that is going to be a healthy career to get into?
I mean, I think this is, you know, that this is one of the real live concerns, and one of the things that I'm having lots of conversations about at the moment. So we know from previous crises that have happened that unemployment, particularly, and unemployment at the start of someone's career can have a real detrimental impact for the rest of their career, both in the level of wages that they can achieve, which, you know, mm-hmm. as I mentioned before, can then impact on their health via their income and via the standard of living that they can achieve for the rest of their life, but also it can also affect their employment chances in future. So, you know, if they're unemployed at the start of their career, their employment history throughout the rest of their career can be much more difficult. As I said, it's really, really welcome that there is focus on employment at all, because making sure that young people don't spend large periods of unemployment is incredibly important right now. But within that focus, making sure that young people, the site doesn't get lost of quality of work. So one of the things that we were seeing before the pandemic was large amount of young people in work, but not in work that was the sort that would be able to protect their health. So they were in quite a lot of insecure contracts, for instance, which meant that they had the stress and uncertainty of not knowing whether or not you're going to be able to make your rent at the end of the month. So, you know, that stress has an impact on the body, and that sort of uncertainty around employment can then feed into some of the other things that I was mentioning earlier around, sense of identity, sense of purpose, sense of progression, which again can have a strong impact on mental health. So it is a real challenge at the moment, because we wouldn't want to lose sight of making sure that as many young people are in work as can be, because, you know, we know unemployment is incredibly bad for work. But just, you know, that the idea that any job is better than no job to a certain extent needs balancing out as well, because we've known from the last couple of years that, you know, that quality of work really matters as well.
Yeah. These challenges, are they kind of being seen for young people the world over, or is this particularly bad in the UK?
So one of the things that is clear is that there's the challenges that have lasted since the sort of 2008 recession have played out differently in different countries. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the ways in which the UK has was coping up until the coronavirus crisis was very much in the focus around levels of employment. So we were doing sort of very well in maintaining young people in work. I think at the moment it's really difficult to say how well the UK is doing compared to other places in the world. What's been really welcome has been things like the furlough scheme, which, you know, in the current environment, that was really, really welcome. And, you know, young people were, you know, compared to older age groups, a lot more young people were being put on furlough than other age groups, and that's often to do with the sectors that young people were working in. So young people were working in hospitality, young people working in retail, a lot of them were put on furlough. So hopefully as we, you know, as the economy starts opening up again, a lot of those young people can continue, you know, can go back to their workplaces and you know, hopefully can sort of continue on in a way that hasn't been too bumpy for them.
Yeah, the furlough scheme was obviously a lifeline for a lot of people, and now there's the whole benefits for taking back those people who were put on furlough. So the policy for young people through the pandemic has been quite good. But what about in general the landscape of government policy on young people? What does it look like, or what do we need to see change?
So, I mean, COVID-19 has sort of compounded some of the challenges that were already out there in the landscape for young people. So as I mentioned, we did this piece of work where we went out to places across the UK, and two really strong themes came out as important in those those areas. One of which was around youth services, and one of which was around transport. And there are still sort of huge, huge questions that need to be answered in both of those areas. So on youth services particularly, we've seen how valuable these are for young people in building important personal connections and softer skills. But London Youth were reporting that around a third of youth services in the capital might not reopen after the COVID crisis. And that's, you know, to my understanding, that's a similar picture that's playing out across England. And that's against a as you know, a background of sort of cuts to youth services over the previous decade, and a youth sector that, you know, was already struggling quite substantially. So there's that, you know, there has been sort of gesturing and announcements in the past around youth services, but they've a lot of them have remained unconfirmed, and they're not, you know, the status of that at the moment is really, really uncertain. So it's it feels important that there are some, you know, big questions around youth services that need answering. And the other big area that needs recognition is around transport for young people. So in many parts of the UK, it's just impossible for young people who don't drive to be able to take up the opportunities around them. So, for example, one of the young women we worked with in North Wales didn't drive. And the local bus services to her village were so poor that she actually couldn't get to college in time to be able to do the A-levels that she wanted to do. So she then had to choose different A-levels, and that locked her out of an apprenticeship scheme that she wanted to get to. That connectivity that young people can get through transport's really not looked at in transport policy. So it really needs sort of some focus on the younger age groups there. And especially sort of cost particularly can lock young people out of transport and of being able to get to opportunities. And you can really see, you know, London at the moment, again, is reversing its zip card scheme, which has been providing free transport to young people and really enabling young people in the capital to be able to take up opportunities when they're available. And, you know, again, the young people we engaged with would absolutely calculate the cost of their bus fare to and back when considering taking up work, or, you know, being able to get to training schemes or other opportunities. So I think a real focus there on, you know, how young people get to the things that are on offer to them is really, really important.
Yeah, it sounds like that is kind of something that not a lot of people consider when they think about young people and their health in the future. You don't think about the connectivity and the transport opportunities that are in their area. So that's really important. One thing I was going to ask, I mean, is this basically all, if we bring it down to the bare bones, is it all kind of financial, the issues that we have around young people? Can it all be solved if we did have like a magic money tree, or is it not that simple?
So what we found throughout a lot of our work is how interconnected a lot of this is, and how there needs to be a lot of small and medium-sized changes across a sort of all manner of different areas of policy. And one of the things we call for in the Healthy Lives team at the Health Foundation, sort of wider than young people, is a strategy that looks at the wider impacts of health more generally, and looks at how all of the, you know, different areas of government policy do have this impact on the wider health of the population. So I think there is some change that needs to happen around recognising how many of these sort of social policy factors do have an impact on health, and how being able to recognise that and appreciate that and develop that can, you know, create an environment that means that, you know, young people are able to thrive, but also means that it should lead to a healthier population in general.
Yeah, so a social change would kind of be what, like, needed in addition to the funding.
Yeah.
And what about the, because I know the Health Foundation has a networked data lab. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because we had the man from the National Innovation Centre for Data on the show, and he was talking about health data a lot, and how especially health and social care has a lot to stand to benefit from using data.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big areas that the Health Foundation has developed in the last several years is around around data and around sort of, you know, what the NHS and others can learn from being able to understand the data that they've already got. So we have analysts who help support NHS England and others to be able to look at what their data tells them about the quality of services that are on offer. But we also work to try and link up you know, help NHS bodies in particular areas to link up with the local authorities in their local areas or the care homes in their local areas, and sort of understand what that sort of joined up data might be able to tell them about, you know, for instance, whether or not a way that care is being structured in a particular place is helpful for, you know, hospital attendances within the sort of, you know, care home population age group. So yeah, there's a rich sort of set of information, and particularly, I mean, one of our award programs within our data analytics team is around in helping those people in the NHS who are sort of good with data and keen to understand the data that they've already got, just understand the sort of understand and fund some of the projects that they might want to work with, in part to be able to help improve the skill that they have and you know, build up the skills within the teams and within the NHS to be able to really understand data a bit more and use it to improve quality and use it to improve patient experience.
Yeah, that's definitely the message that I'm hearing. I think the first thing you said about being able to access the data that they already have, that's the key, is that, you know, they already have it. It's just being able to access it. So what kind of advice would you give to young people then if they were looking to kind of have a more positive life or change? Maybe their siblings or their parents have had a certain kind of life and they want to make theirs more positive. How would you kind of guide them to make that decision?
I mean, I think one of the things we always emphasise is how interconnected sort of everybody's lives are, and how important recognizing that, you know, certain, if you move one thing in one place, it'll change sort of things in another place, sometimes in ways that might not be expected. The key areas that we really looked at were around, as I've mentioned, the skills and qualifications. So the young people who had greater skills and qualifications seemed to be able to open more doors to more opportunities across different ways. Similarly, the financial and practical support was incredibly important. So those people who had a network of support around them, supportive families, supportive friends, but also, you know, sort of had that, you know, family safety net, that were able to move back in with their move back into their childhood bedroom if they needed to, sort of that confidence to move forward, also, you know, seemed to be doing slightly better. Emotional support, as I said, was incredibly important. So nurturing the places where young people get emotional support, again, that felt really important. And then again, these sort of personal connections that I mentioned, where if there were sort of people around who were able to give sort of very practical advice, that was really important. But I think one of the other things that, again, is really, really key to mention is that, you know, this isn't individual a lot of the time, in that some of our early work really found how young people were almost sort of overly keen to, you know, take the blame when they felt like their lives weren't panning out in the way that they you know, had imagined it might be. So I think, again, emphasizing to young people that, you know, if you haven't bought a house by the age that your parents had bought a house by, then actually you're living in an incredibly different world. And, you know, the housing market in your area may be incredibly different to the housing market than it was 30, 40 years ago that you're comparing your life to. So I think making sure that sort of young people still sort of, well, don't beat themselves up, essentially, that they sort of understand the forces around them that aren't, you know, aren't within their control, and, you know, understand that they're living through really, really challenging times.
Yeah, and at the moment, especially, the most challenging of times that I think any of us have ever kind of known. But have there been any positives in 2020 that you'd like to draw on, or maybe that you think are going to have a long-term positive effect, like the push for active travel or anything like that?
I mean, several of the things that have come up in 2020 have shown, you know, actually how important some of the areas we've been working on in the Health Foundation are. So particularly community came out. And we saw a lot in the media around community, and we're beginning to see, you know, the ONS reported in early June that around 80% of people were doing more to support others in their community, compared to maybe only 35% earlier on, before the lockdown. And I think we saw this. We've been doing some interviews with some of our young reference group about what their life was like during lockdown, and they talked a lot more about supporting their families and supporting, being able to do shopping for elderly neighbours and members of their spiritual communities and others. And I think that focus that we had during lockdown on the importance of community and the importance of the wider surroundings around you, I think showed highlighted something that I think potentially we all take for granted a lot. And another area I'd just highlight that became a sort of necessary priority for the government during lockdown was around housing security. So the local housing allowance was restored to previous levels during March. So people on rental contracts could actually afford 30% of rental housing stock. And this meant that, the Chartered Institute for Housing thinks that this is likely to have prevented 6,000 households from becoming homeless, and it's lifted 32,000 households out of poverty. This is a measure that's only, currently scheduled to last for 12 months. But I think one of the things that showed is that actually when it comes down to it, there is an acknowledgement of how important housing and secure housing is. And if we can keep on, policies that acknowledge how actually secure housing is actually important to health over the long term and can have this sort of wider connected impact onto people's lives, then I think, that could really show the importance of, a national level action and how it's, cascading to affect thousands of people.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Public Sector Voices. Stay tuned for next week's episode as we're joined by Chair and Chief Executive of the National Association of Local Councils, Councillor Sue Baxter and Jonathan Owen.